podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, which this week is a sort of review of the year and even the decade, actually, since we've come to the end of one, and also a preview of both England in South Africa and also a bit about Australia against New Zealand. And in the second half, because very much Christmas is the time when most sports books, and in fact any books, are bought, I thought we'd focus on the best cricket books of the year and interview one of the leading cricket writers, a guy who is a multi-award winning author, Duncan Hamilton, to talk about his new book. So that's coming up in the second half. First, though, what's your sort of highlight of the year, would you say? What's your memorable moment?
What, one moment, one incident of the year? I think you'd have to go to Headingley. I know England won the World Cup this year and there was that dramatic finish and all sorts going on in the last hour or so. But I think Headingley, Ben Stokes reverse sweeping Nathan Lyon for six into the West Stand, and the noise that day, I think that will stay with me for a very, very long time. Incredible afternoon's cricket. England were down and somehow Ben Stokes revived them and kept the Ashes series alive. So although I think as an achievement, winning the World Cup for England was sort of the highlight of the year, just in terms of just one moment, that moment when Ben Stokes reverse swept Nathan Lyon, I think everyone just looked at each other and thought, did he just do what I think he just did? An astonishing stroke.
I suppose mine would have to be the World Cup final, and actually, although that mad moment when Stokes dived in and the ball ricocheted off his bat and went for four, you know, that was bizarre. And it almost sort of underlined the fact that it was England were fated to win, and also actually Trent Bolt stepping on the rope as well. But just that final moment when, with two runs to win, New Zealand skeltering for the line in the personage of Martin Guptill, and obviously just falling a metre short, Jason Roy, who'd fumbled the ball earlier in the over, getting the throw accurately to Jos Buttler, who virtually destroyed the stumps. And then that image of the players all embracing, and actually Ben Stokes poleaxed on the ground in exhaustion. I think he slipped over, actually, in setting off to join the throng and actually fell to the ground. And you can see him just briefly in one of the camera pictures, completely prostrate on the ground, almost beyond exhaustion, really. Let's just recap that moment.
Here it is, folks. This is the moment. It's Archer to Guptill. Two to win. Guptill's going to push for two. They've got to go. It's got to throw. It's got to go to the keeper's end.
Go on, go on.
Yeah!
So that actually was recorded from the VT truck at the back of the nursery end, which I was sat in with a load of technicians, and you can hear the excitement there in their voices, as well as, of course, Ian Smith, who has had a great year himself, actually. Ian Smith commentated brilliantly on that World Cup final, and he's been in vintage form during the series in New Zealand as well.
Yeah, not sure he was so happy after the Perth Test match, though, where New Zealand absolutely crushed. Australia just set them up so nicely for that. You could see it coming from a long way off. Pink ball Test match in Perth, bouncy pitch, hot conditions, complete contrast to the conditions in Hamilton and indeed at the Bay Oval where they played the first Test match against England. Also, the jet lag factor as well, going from New Zealand all the way over to Perth. People don't think of there being that much of jet lag, but there is a bit involved. All sorts of factors. Australia just played a pink ball Test match against Pakistan. They set them up nicely, as they often do, actually, Australia, don't they? Nice itinerary to suit their own team. Normally go to Brisbane first for a first match of a series. But this time it was Perth, which was really tough for New Zealand, and they were crushed, really. They were crushed in that Test match.
I mean, actually, you're right about, flying from Auckland to Perth is the equivalent of flying from London to the Middle East, isn't it? So Dubai or something like that.
Yeah.
And with the similar kind of contrast as well.
Yeah, it was really tough for them. Pitch was bouncy. People talk about the new Perth Stadium. Is it going to be a bit like the Wacker? Actually, the Wacker's gone a bit tame, or went a bit tame in recent years. But they've certainly found some pace and bounce in that Perth Stadium, and it's going to be tough for batsmen going there.
And I suppose it also, in a way, confirmed the batsman of the year, although Steve Smith would lay some claim to that. The batsman of the year in the 12 months has actually been Marlis Labuschagne, who's scored more than 1,000 test runs. He scored another 100 in that Perth test match. He's a bit of a kind of Smith clone, in a way. But you were doing that test match, weren't you? I mean, it must have been another phenomenal performance by someone who actually is more interesting to watch than Smith, in a way.
Yeah, I thought actually he should have been man of the match. He scored over 190 runs in the match. Mitchell Starc at 9 wickets, but I thought there was enough there for the bowlers. I know Labuschagne got the runs in the first innings when the pitch was at its best. It became very cracked as the match went on. I just thought that Labuschagne's performance really set up Australia's victory. And when once they got 400 plus in their first innings, that was it. The bowlers were going to get to work on that Perth surface. Starc bowled well. He was a handful, but he was bowling on that second evening. He was bowling under the lights. Perfect conditions with the pink ball to bowl under the lights. Mm. And he just exploited it very well. So, but I thought Labuschagne was really the man that set up Australia's victory.
And, of course, it's going to be tough for New Zealand in that second test match starting on Boxing Day at the MCG. A lot of cricket going on, isn't there? We've had Pakistan, Sri Lanka, test cricket returning to Pakistan, a heavy defeat for Sri Lanka, and an interesting performance in that game. 5 wickets for Nazim Shah, 16 years old, the second youngest ever bowler to take 5 wickets in innings, and he is absolutely phenomenal looking character. Pace, swing, lovely action, rhythm, aggression. He could be one to really look out for.
Yeah, and the top 4 in Pakistan's second innings, all making 100 as well, in 550 plus for 3 declared. And the interesting aspect of that tour, of course, now will be, will sides feel compelled to go and play test cricket in Pakistan, or will teams have cold feet? England are due to go there in the not-too-distant future. What do they do? Do they say no? Obviously, they'll look at the security side of it. Reg Dickerson, who does all the security for the England team, he'll go there and assess everything and make a decision. And they basically go on Reg's say-so. If Reg says it's fine to go, then England presumably will go there. Whether we'll see one or two players pull out, I don't know. If not, then it might be back in the UAE or another part of the world. But Pakistan, they seem absolutely convinced and confident that test cricket should be played in Pakistan. Although Bangladesh have said we're happy to go there for T20s, but not for test matches. So we'll wait and see on that one. But it's significant that test cricket is back in Pakistan.
As far as England are concerned, obviously they play their first test in South Africa, starting also on Boxing Day at Centurion, a departure from the norm, because normally that Boxing Day test in South Africa is at Durban, Kingsmead.
And well, you talk about the Australians, having that first fixture in a favourable venue. Of course, England have a good record in Durban. They've done well in Durban. So I don't know whether the South Africans have said, no, we're not going to let them have that advantage. We're going to play it on a bouncier track at altitude at Centurion and try and get at England in that first game. It looks like it.
And you know, altitude is a big thing in South Africa for two reasons, actually. One, obviously the ball flies further. So Johannesburg, the Wanderers, the ball does fly for 6 more easily in one-day internationals especially. And actually, and having played a season of first-class cricket in South Africa, it does make a difference playing at altitude compared to playing at the coast. You know, you do feel short of breath playing in Joburg or Centurion compared to down on the coast in Durban or Cape Town. So, yeah, interesting to see how England deal with that. And they've got health issues of their own.
Well, that's it. Yeah, are the players fit to come out and bowl? Well, and they might say they're fit. Stuart Broad and Jofra Archer in particular, those are the bowlers that England are desperate to have in that test match, especially Jofra Archer. Of course, they'll want to carry him around, you know, wherever they play, because he's such a threat, and that he's hoping, and England are hoping, that he'll make the Kookaburra ball do something in South Africa. Stuart Broad said it's a good place to bowl with the Kookaburra ball, and that there is pace and bounce at Centurion, there is pace and bounce at the Wanderers. So, but are they going to be fit? It's been a tight turnaround for England. They had a really tough time of it in New Zealand. It was, you know, really hard work, I think, mentally and physically. I was listening to Ashley Giles the other day talking about whether England have actually still have overcome the tough summer they've had. I know some of the players had a break and they didn't play in the T20 series, but whether they really have overcome the tough summer. And, you know, New Zealand, quick turnaround, off to South Africa, illness in the camp. South Africa now have reorganised themselves. They sort of got their house in order just in time. Graham Smith, interim director of cricket. Mark Boutcher, a new coach. Jack Calais, batting consultant. Charles Langeveld, bowling consultant. They've been quite an experienced squad as well. I don't think it'd be as straightforward for England as some people are suggesting. It might take them a bit of time to get in the series. We'll know after Centurion. But England, it seems to me, England are not set up for a fall, but it will not be as straightforward as many people are predicting.
And I'm very interested to see, for all those people who poo-poo the idea of coaches, international coaches, and the effect they have, what effect three star players who've now been recruited into the frame as coaching staff, or effectively, if Graham Smith is director of cricket, but will obviously have a say in how the game is played, and Mark Boutcher, as you say, and also Jack Calais. You know, how much influence can those guys actually have on the players? And maybe quite a bit, because they picked some experienced players who, I think experienced players have got more ability to listen to advice and try and put it into practice than a young player who's sort of trying to find his way. You often find with young players, they say, oh, look, you know, I've been bombarded with different suggestions and I don't really know who to listen to. Whereas I think when you've established your game a bit, like some of these players in the squad have, then just little bits of advice from the likes of Calais, it might just be a reassurance, it might just be looking out for a particular type of scoring shot on that surface, I don't know. But I think they can. Well, it'll be interesting to see if they have an influence.
Yeah, I was actually fascinated by the squad that South Africa have picked. And they've got some of the familiar names, you know, the likes of Rabada and Duplessis and Quinton de Kock and Dean Elgar, who's a fine opener. What they have done is they've picked experienced batsmen and bowlers who've got good records in first-class cricket in South Africa. And they're a proud sporting nation, South Africa. Everyone thought England were going to win the Rugby World Cup final, but South Africa stood up to them and bullied them and dominated them and beat them quite comfortably on the day. And I know England have got a good record in South Africa. And the South African series, I think, are always really good. They're always really watchable. I'm really looking forward to it. I think England have got a chance. Of course they've got a chance. But I don't think this England side is that good. They've got some very good players, and we've talked about it for a while. And if those very good players perform, then South Africa will be under pressure. But as an all-round team, they're a bit creaky, and there are some cracks in that team.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was actually just looking at the records of a couple of players of the year. You know, Rory Burns, who has definitely established himself as England's sort of number one opener. And how's he gone over the year? Well, his record is 11 tests, 731 runs, average 34.8. So that's actually a slightly better performance than his overall average, which is only 32. Not bad, actually. Mm. Dealing with, obviously, the Duke's ball for a lot of those test matches in England. So I remember Alistair Cook, his last year of test cricket, only averaged about 28 or something. Mm. So he's a slight improvement on that, but still work to be done there. And to pick out, you know, England's player of the year, not much doubt about who that is, Ben Stokes. And, you know, fantastic record, actually. 30 matches in all formats, 719 runs, average 53. Mm. He's averaged 53 in, you know, a combination of tests, one days and T20. So he's had a fabulous year, capped by his elevation as BBC Sports Personality of the Year. But as you say, you know, fragile top order. Joe Denley made 100 in that warm-up game. Mm. So did Ollie Pope. He's going to be one that's starting to emerge. That middle order looks fine. Again, it's still that top order you worry about.
Yeah, one thing England have done this year is they've tried to sort out a structure to their team. We've talked about in the past that the structure seems all wrong. You know, lots of all-rounders, no one at the top. They've tried to address that. But the question is, will they be able to do it successfully? It's all very well having the right structure, you know, a top order that's suited to test match cricket, an all-rounder, five batsmen, a spinner, and then your pace bowlers. But you've still got to find that all-round quality in a side. Jimmy Anderson coming back into the side. He bowled in the warm-up games. He bowled very well in the second match. Very good figures. Got through 30 overs. But you don't quite know how that's going to work out on South African pitches. A guy who's, 37 years of age. A canny bowler. But are South Africa just going to be able to sit on him? It sort of depends who's at the other end, really. If you've got Archer...
Yeah, it's a tantalising prospect, yeah. Archer and Anderson,
yeah,
isn't it? If
it is.
They're both...
Yeah.
Obviously, if Archer's fit. Mm. But, you know, it's... Anderson hasn't had a great record in South Africa the previous series. You know, it's going to be fascinating to see if he can still recapture that magic and that extra bit of zip. Amazing performance over the decade. I said we were going to quickly pick out a couple of things from the decade, and two players in the world undoubtedly stand out. Jimmy Anderson, 106 tests in the 2010 decade, 430 test wickets at an average of 24.25. That's phenomenal performance just in playing 100 tests in a decade. Yeah. I mean, it's
for a pace bowler.
For a pace bowler.
He's such a great bowler to watch. It's fascinating to watch him. He's a craftsman, and it'll be sad when he's no longer bowling for England. I'm looking forward to watching him bowl again, actually, to see, you know, whether he's still got it, whether he can still cause problems. He's had, 6 months out of the game with that calf injury. As you know, you've said it yourself, you know, as you get older into your 30s, it's not so easy. I remember you saying before that a ball that you bowled when you were 25, you thought you propelled it at the same speed as 33 as you did at 25, but at 25 it's finding the outside edge or whatever, or hurrying the batsman. At 33, it's disappearing over deep backwards square leg for six.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it doesn't feel any different when you're letting go of it. You feel it's still got that venom, but the batsman just seems to have a lot more time. So, yeah, well, let's hope Jimmy's sinewy muscles are able to have that same elasticity and take wickets. Of course, the batting star of the decade needs no introduction, Virat Kohli. And I mean,
the stats are amazing, aren't they?
These stats are remarkable. So in all formats since 2010, 388 matches, 21,067 runs, average 57.71.
In all formats.
57.71 average in all formats, and 70 hundreds. All his hundreds, in fact, all his international hundreds have been made in this decade.
Shouldn't be allowed, should it, really? It's utterly.
And he made 80 again today.
Utterly, you know, greedy.
One day international. Yeah, but insatiability. Yeah. And I think you're born with that. Mm. I don't think you can become that insatiable. You just have it within you. And clearly Steve Smith has it as well. Steve Smith doesn't have that record yet because he didn't really kind of get his act together until later in the decade.
Mm. But it seems to me, talk about Smith, you talk about Warner in Australia, you talk about Labuschagne emerging, they've got those fast bowlers as well. Just looking ahead, as we often do in cricket, those Ashes coming up in a couple of years' time, Australia looking
very strong.
Formidable, aren't they, really? I mean, what England were hoping is, you look at that batting lineup and you think, oh, well, as long as their batting is thin, there's an opportunity. There's only Smith, but Warner, Renaissance, that's not a great surprise, actually, in Australian conditions. Although 2 years' time, he'll be about 36. But Labuschagne, he looks the real deal. Mm. They've got Smith as well. And then if you can play around those three batsmen, there's enough strength in that Australian batting now to get big enough totals. And then they've got the pace bowlers, if they can keep them fixed. Because Josh Hazlewood broke down in the first test match. They do have other options. That's the thing, isn't it? Can they keep the pace bowlers fit? But there's a lot of pace bowling talent generally in Australian cricket. So even if the big guys are injured, there are still some promising bowlers that can come in behind them.
So we think Australia are going to beat New Zealand in that series. Mm. What about a prediction for England, South Africa then? Four tests. Mm. I'm siding with you, actually. I think South Africa just might have, you know, they haven't had a good year generally. I don't think they've won a test match since about January.
They lost twice. To Sri Lanka, didn't they? They got thrashed in India, but then everyone's going to get thrashed in India at the moment. I think England will go to India next summer, next winter, and be well beaten. They'll find it really tough, as they did last time. So people saying, "Oh, that South African side, they went to India, they were steamrolled. They're rubbish." Well, let's see England go there and do better than that.
I'm worried about England's bowling, actually, in South Africa, because I think Archer may not be fully fit for the first test, whether he plays or not. And I don't know whether England still got that potency, enough of it, to really take wickets in South African conditions against some quite tough competitors like Dean Elgar, for instance, obviously Faf du Plessis. There'll be something really gritty and determined about that South African team. England are going to have trouble, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard series to predict, but what I don't see is England winning 3-0 or something like that, which I think there was a feeling that, oh yeah, England will go there and they'll be too good for South Africa. I don't see it as clearly as that. Okay, they might happen, but to me it seems a much more unpredictable series, a hard fought, like there may be some fascinating cricket. I always think there's England South Africa series, especially in South Africa, are really, really watchable. The weather's good, it's warm, the pitches are good, and they reward good pace bowling, but they also help the batsmen as well. You can get in and score big runs. So it'll be a test ring. I think it's a question of whether they're big players, you know, Root and Stokes and Archer and Anderson are able to have a significant effect on the series.
It's a great opportunity for the armchair watcher anyway, isn't it, over the holiday period. You've got England, South Africa during the day and then a couple of hours off, and then you can watch Australia, New Zealand. Fantastic. Right, so have you finished your Christmas shopping?
I have.
Have you bought any books for anybody?
I don't think I have.
It's really sad.
Not because I...
Not even a Private Eye annual or, you know...
Not because I'm not obsessed with books.
The Viz annual 2019.
I buy lots of books for myself, but other people don't seem that keen on reading
them.
Yeah, as much as I'm keen on reading myself.
Well, there is obviously a big surge of book buying at this time of year. It's generally the peak of the book buying season. And I thought we'd sort of just focus on cricket books a bit, because the poor old impecunious authors don't get a huge amount of plugging, cricket authors, I mean. And there's one guy who's particularly noticeable at the moment, Duncan Hamilton, who's just written The Great Romantic, Cricket and the Golden Age of Neville Cardus, the famous writer in the early part of the 20th century. And he's got quite a track record, actually, Duncan Hamilton, in terms of writing biographies of famous sporting personalities. So actually, he won an award with his book about Brian Clough. He also won an award with his book about Harold Larwood as well. Have you got a favourite cricket book? Go on, plug mine, go on.
All right, then. I did. I'll just twist my arm behind me. I did enjoy your book, a lot of Hardy Acker. Because what I liked about it, and I think this, all good sports books sort of take you inside the dressing room, don't they? They give you that sense of what it's like to be a fly on the wall or even a player inside that dressing room. So, yeah, I did enjoy your book, Yoz, even though it pains me to say it, a lot of Hardy Acker. Another cricket book that I liked, Art of Captaincy by Mike Brearley. That story he told about putting the helmet at mid-wicket, it's always stayed with me, the idea to get the batsman to play across a spinner and trying to get him to work it and make a mistake. Of course, that's been outlawed now. They've changed the laws, haven't they?
So the idea was you get five runs if you can hit the ball against the helmet.
So there's that temptation to hit the helmet. You might play across a straight ball and miss it and get a wicket. I think he was desperate for wickets. So, those two cricket books. I really liked Vic Marks's book this year. I know I'm biased. He wrote about times in my sort of teenage years and into my 20s, I remember so clearly, down in the West Country, his time at Somerset, and obviously I've travelling around the world with him over many years subsequently. So I really enjoyed that.
Sports books generally, you like the kind of dressing room tales, don't you?
Yeah, I think you want that insight. I mean, you don't like biographies or autobiographies where they say, oh yeah, I was disappointed with that shot. You want the stories, don't you? You want to know what's going on
emotion
behind the scenes. Yeah, you want and the feel of it and the behind the scenes stories. I mean, for that reason, I think of three football books actually. The Glory Game by Hunter Davis about the inside the Tottenham dressing room.
1970s Tottenham.
Yeah. Only a Game.
Eamon Dumphy. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. And the Miracle of Castel di Sangri, which is a book about Italian lower league football, where the writer lived and breathed the whole season with them. And that's a fascinating sports book as well. I think what they all have in common is just that feeling of being behind the scenes of this is what it's like, or at least it gives you a flavour of what it's like to be right at the heart of that team or dressing room or even the boardroom.
those sort of books allow you to smell the dressing room, don't they? So whether it's deep heat or some other product or,
it's hair gel these days, isn't it?
Probably is, yeah, exactly. Another one I particularly liked and really influenced me, I read Hunter Davis's Glory Game and also Eamon Dunphy, Only a Game. Mm. There was a wonderful accounts of football in the 1970s. Was Fever Pitch, obviously, Nick Hornby, which was different because, obviously, it was more about his relationship with his father and his passion for Arsenal. So it was much more of an outsider's view, but still compelling to read. And that's what you want, is emotion. You want to find out what people were really feeling in those situations. I was very influenced by Fever Pitch, actually by another book, which was about football, Left Foot Forward, Gary Nelson, which I think was about either Millwall or Charlton. I forget which club now. And generally, those books just give you a deeper sense of actually being there. And I've found them really compelling.
And I also, because I'm a sort of batting geek, and if someone would want to bowl at me all day, I would bat all day, even now. And people know me, know my Desert Island Discs sort of luxury item would be a cricket net and a bowling machine and batting equipment, so I could just bat all day in the sunshine.
Yeah.
So I did enjoy your book on batting, and Steve James wrote a book on batting at the same time, and I enjoyed them both as well.
Well, that's high praise. This year, the ones we've picked out in the Cricketer magazine, particularly, I thought Robin Smith's The Judge was quite a poignant book about his rise into the game and then his fall into depression and problems with alcohol and so on. Very heartfelt book. The others we could pick out as well include the one you mentioned there, Vic Mark's Original Spin, which is very much an account of his own life in the game. The award-winning book by the Australian writer Jeff Lemon, Steve Smith's Men, looking at the fallout from that famous Sandpapergate scandal in Cape Town. It's definitely worth the read. And we should also pick out Duncan Hamilton's The Great Romantic, as I mentioned before, all about the cricket writer Neville Cardus. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk to Duncan about his writing methods and how he picks his subjects. So that was my first question.
A few years ago, what I wanted to do was to write a book about the last cricket summer before the Great War. And so I went back and I looked at all the papers from 1914, and all the match reports were so poor. I mean, there was no description at all in there of the way a ground looked or what the weather was really like or basically, you know, the way that a kind of batsman either scored his runs or a bowler took his wickets. And it wasn't really then until I looked again at 1919 and Cardus's match reports during that summer were just so different from everybody else's. And he just completely changed the way that everybody wrote about sport. It wasn't only about cricket. Soon, within about 5 or 6 years, everybody wanted their own Neville Cardus. And they were desperate to go and find somebody like that. And he lived such a complicated life. And he just seemed to me to be one of those figures who no one had actually got to the bottom of. And one of the rules I have, if I'm picking somebody to write a biography of, is simply this. Where am I going to start and where am I going to end? But most significantly of all, what is the middle chapter? Because lots of biographies are written about people and everybody will have a beginning and an end, but not everyone has a kind of satisfying middle period to their life, which would make fascinating reading. The real fascinating middle period of his life was that it changed when he went on Gubby Allen's tour in 36-7, and he kind of always wanted to go and see Sydney, and he was at that period of his life where he'd been covering cricket for almost 20 years. He was in a marriage which was peculiar to say the least. and he didn't want to leave his girlfriend, despite the fact that the kind of sexual bit of their relationship was long over. But he really had to go in 36-7. And of course, when he actually went, I mean, he found himself fated. I mean, it was like sort of Dickens turning up in New York. I mean, he overworked himself. But he just had a thoroughly fantastic time. Then, of course, when he came back, he couldn't really get back into the swing of covering ordinary championship matches and kind of tests here. And then his girlfriend died, and she died very suddenly. And it just changed his entire outlook on life, and he became very gloomy. Everything led up to that point, and then everything afterwards led away from it.
Going back to the start of his writing career, it's interesting that you choose 1919, which, of course, is 100 years ago. And I found, even on page one, quite an interesting comment about the state of the game, because you say here, gloomy about the game's ability to grasp public affection. This is the first season after the First World War. The MCC had debated whether to increase an over from 6 balls to 7, enlarge the stumps and shrink the size of a bat. Even the possibility of banning left-handed batsmen was mooted and then dismissed. It sort of shows, in a way, that cricket is always trying to evolve to attract the public, even 100 years ago.
Yes, and basically the kind of debate that they were having in 1919 was exactly the same debate that they were having in 1939, just before the Second World War. And there was this constant thing with Cardus that he was... that he was always kind of writing about cricket then being a little bit slow at times, whereas actually people were bowling about 140 overs a day. And there were colossal kind of runs being scored, certainly towards the kind of back end of the 30s. And of course, that was on uncovered pitches. But yes, I mean, it does absolutely underline the sheer fact that kind of cricket is always changing, always evolving, and that they're always looking for ways to get new people through the gates.
It says something about the game, isn't it? That we have to keep trying to persuade people to follow it. You mention, actually, fairly early on, that he was quite influenced by Charles Dickens, in that he found ways of describing characters which really painted a rich picture, and I guess he loved characters more than anything else.
Yes, I mean, if you go through his match reports, as I did, Simon, the number of times Dickens crops up, or the number of times a character from Dickens crops up, and he will say, oh, he reminds me of so-and-so from such-and-such a novel. And I think that he kind of looked at it as being a kind of theatre, really, and he wanted to pretend that all the cricketers were actually actors, and the pitch was the stage. And that is kind of basically how he tackled every single game. And he would look at somebody and think, oh yeah, he will make a very good subject. And there are match reports where he will just concentrate on one person.
I love the... there's a couple of quotes here you mention. Hedley Verity, a bowler as secret and self-contained as an oyster, and a description of a Walter Hammond cut shot as a Tower Hill stroke. You could almost see the axe and the block.
Yes.
So yeah. Lots of sort of different metaphors and things which just enriched it generally.
Well, I think the thing is that he was very well read. And so he would read anything, and he would read... I mean, I don't think he actually read very much cricket. I think he normally read novels, or he would read philosophy, or he'd read travel books and things like that. And so he kind of brought all that knowledge with him. And one of the other things that I always find fascinating is that he seldom sat in the press box. He didn't particularly like sitting in press boxes, and he would literally pick... I mean, he had a favourite spot... virtually every ground that he went to, and that's where he would sit. Because John Arlott said he was the father of literate sports writing, and if you were to draw a family tree of sports writers, he would be right at the top. And I think that everybody has been influenced, certainly if they cover cricket, has been influenced by Cardis in some kind of way. Even if you don't want to copy him, then you're still thinking of him.
Do you think, though, just playing devil's advocate, that at times perhaps he left a legacy of cricket being a bit of an elite sport? We still struggle at times to convince people that cricket isn't a sort of, you know, upper-class sport played by elite from the establishment, if you like.
I think that's a fair point because, as you know, Cardis came from very impoverished circumstances, and he made sure that he left no kind of trace of that background on him. I mean, he used it obviously when he came to write his life story, and it was a fantastic bit of sort of grist to the mill, really. But generally speaking, he did become a very kind of higher kind of echelon style writer, and so he didn't really have a great rapport with the common man, I don't think, despite the fact he was one himself.
As far as your writing techniques are concerned, I mean, you've written a number of very successful biographies. This one, I notice at the back, in the references section, there's an exhaustive list of books that you've consulted. How long does it take to write one of your books, and what is your kind of daily process? What's your daily routine?
My daily routine is to get up as early as I can, and usually I just start working. I don't shave or wash. I just go and start work. And when I first came to live here, I'd suddenly discover it was 11:30 in the morning, and the doorbell was ringing, and it was the postman. And I would go down looking as if I'd just sort of climbed out of bed. And for a while, he thought I was the laziest person in Yorkshire. But I'd actually been up since 6:30. And he finally cottoned on. So the actual process is to try and do, if I can, anywhere between 500 to 1,000 words a day. And sometimes you can only write 450. And other days you can write 1,500. And I tend to think that once you've done the research, I mean, Cardis took 6 months to write, but the research started in 2012 or 2011, simply because there was so much to read. I mean, you wrote millions and millions of words, and you've got to turn every page because you never know what you might find on the next page.
What do you think? What do you think Neville Cardis would have made of the 100?
Oh, I don't think he would have thought very much about 2020. I think he would have found a way to write about it, because writers always do. But I don't think he would have particularly liked it, because he liked to watch, you know, I mean, he kind of liked a game to build slowly to a kind of climax, really. And I think he probably wouldn't have liked the sameness of it.
So the 100 is coming to a ground near you very shortly.
Even if you don't want it to, it is coming.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly lots of people don't want it. I did a lunch at the Sheffield Cricket Lover Society last week, at which was not only Michael Vaughan's father, but also Joe Root's grandfather, Don. And there was very little enthusiasm for the 100 amongst that assembled crowd. But I did try to convince them it's important for the game, and it is a bat and a ball and a pitch of 22 yards still. It is still cricket. Just the commitment that Duncan Hamilton has shown to writing really impresses me, actually, because, you know, you're saying getting up at 6:30 in the morning and writing till lunchtime, and looking to try and write 1,000 words. And I don't know how often he suffers from writer's block, but I do, and it's terrible. It's like sort of constipation. You don't know how to cure it, really. I go to the gym. Doesn't necessarily help, but it sort of takes me away from doing something, a sedentary life. But great to hear Duncan still having tremendous success with his books. And the great romantic... I love some of the little stories in it. There's one where he tells the story of Neville Cardis putting semicolons in his prose, and some sub-editor saying, talking about the print work, saying, "We don't have semicolons here." So Cardis actually goes and drives somewhere and actually goes and finds the block with semicolon on it to put it into his prose.
I must just pick up on one thing you referred to in the interview, that banning left-handedness in cricket. Well, they were talking about banning left-handers in cricket in 1919.
Well, actually, left-handed...
That's totally discriminatory.
It is, isn't it? Left-handers were almost regarded as a sort of criminals in society, actually. It was regarded as something, you know, a bit sort of weird. And there weren't many left-handed writers in, you know, 200 years ago. I thought it was interesting to hear Neville Carter's, how he would have approached the 100. And I particularly like a cartoon on the cover of the Christmas issue of the Cricketer magazine, which, don't forget, you can get a special deal on. If you go to thecricketer.com/Christmas, you get a £20 John Lewis voucher or Alistair Cook's autobiography. We didn't mention that in our roundup of books of the year, but it's good. I just like this little cartoon here by Newman, the famous Sunday Times cartoonist, and it's a picture of an ECB official, and he's holding the manifesto of the 100, and he's saying, forget the 12 days of Christmas, the punters want it reduced to 3 hours.
We shall see. We're going to find out in 2020, the 100 in. They've got to sell it, haven't they? They've got to sell it. They've done the deal, we've had the debate. It's now about, we've had the selection process. It's a question now of who's going to come and watch and how many are going to come and watch.
Well, that's it, I think, for today. Certainly looking back on the year, 2019 was a momentous year for English cricket, winning the World Cup for the first time and getting a BBC Sports Personality of the Year in Ben Stokes as well. So a tremendous year for English cricket. Let's hope 2020 is as good. And we'd like to both wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Sports Social Podcast Network.